From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At first, it seemed like a pretty simple question. The journalist Dick Teresi wanted to know, how can you tell when a person's dead? Well, it turned out to be really complicated, and it's a question that humans have worried about since there have been humans. The Greeks would cut off a finger. The Romans would scream a name into your ear. The Hebrews figured the only way you could really tell was when the body started to rot. And today it's still complicated. Are you dead when your heart stops beating or when you no longer have the capacity for consciousness? Teresi says, today it is easier to be declared dead than any time in human history. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his controversial book, where he argues medical technology and organ donations are blurring the line between death and life. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dick Teresi's latest book is about physical death, and it started with a simple question. How do you know when a person is dead? Humans have always pondered the question, you know, has every last drop of life been drained from this body lying here, and when is it safe to put it in the ground? But he figured today, in an era of high-tech medical equipment and techniques, that we had gotten better at pinpointing that moment of death. What he found, though, was that technology hasn't actually illuminated death, as he puts it in his book, but expanded the breadth of our ignorance. Teresi says the standard for being considered alive has changed. We're not asking just, are you alive, but are you a person? And it's a tough standard to reach and define. His book is called The Undead, and in it he explores the history of how we've determined if a person is dead over time and how medical technology and organ donations are blurring that line between life and death. Dick Teresi is joining us, and we invite you to join us as well. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is called The Undead, Organ Harvesting, The Ice Water Test, Beating Heart Cadavers, How Medicine is Blurring the Line Between Life and Death. Dick Teresi is a science writer, a co-author of The God Particle, author of Lost Discoveries, The Ancient Root of Modern Science. He's also been editor-in-chief of Science Digest and Omni, among others. And he's joining us today from the studios of New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts. Dick Teresi, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning.
I wanted to start with the prologue that you've written for the book. Kind of poses one of the central questions you get at, and you know, that is, what is it to be dead? Let's start by talking about Fernanda. She's this 57-year-old woman you saw lying in a bed at a hospital in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I originally started with a co-author who then dropped out, but we were on 12-hour shifts. Waiting for a brain dead person at the local hospital in Springfield, Massachusetts, and we were very much like the people in the organ banks, hoping against hope that someone would be brain dead. It was very ghoulish, and this did not happen on my shift. Fernanda went brain dead on my partner's shift, and she went down there and saw this woman in the ICU about in her early 50s. And the amazing thing is that she was judged to be brain dead, and she was the best-looking patient in the ICU. And it was quite startling how simple the brain dead test was, that it was like a flashlight in the eyes, some ice water in the ears, Q-tips on the eyeballs, looking for reflexes, et cetera, and then what's called the apnea test, where they disconnect the ventilator to see if the patient can breathe on her own, and Fernanda couldn't. Right. And so, voila, she was brain dead, even though nothing seemed to have happened. She didn't seem any different. You know, if you've seen someone die of heart attack, as I have, it's dramatic, the difference between being alive and breathing and then being dead and not breathing. Nothing happened here. She looked like the same person. And what was curious is that during the whole procedure, which took less time than my last eye exam, one of the nurses kept saying, oh, I'll go tell the organ bank. Oh, I'll go tell the organ bank, before she was even declared dead. They were very much aware that this person was worth a great deal for her organs and not worth so much being alive.
The nurse says, whatever it was that made her isn't there anymore.
Yeah, whatever made her her isn't there anymore. And that made me wonder what kind of – which of these tests shows you that the person, unquote, unquote, is gone, that the essential human being is gone? Was it the ice water? Was – you know, there were no machines used. There were no scans taken. When I got into this, I thought I would find this very high technology that would tell us, you know, oh, the person is gone or something like that. But it's come down to a kind of philosophical question. We don't believe this person's life is worth living anymore. We don't believe that they're there. And that's sort of a decision I should think be made by philosophers or someone other than MDs. Mm.
The book began a long time ago, about 10 years ago, you say. And it was at first it was kind of an idea that you figured you'd write for a magazine article. And if I get it right, you were listening to a Charlie Rose interview. It was Carl Sagan. And this is when the question started to kind of percolate in your brain, I guess.
Well, yeah, he was on Charlie Rose, and I knew Carl a little bit. He wrote for me at Omni and at Science Digest when I was editors there. And he is a very good-looking guy, a very healthy-looking guy. He was only 62, I think, at this interview. Yeah. Oh, my God, he looked 80, 90. Yeah. He did not look well. And he had had this kind of cancer, of the blood. And he announced that he had been saved by science and he wasn't going to die. And it turns out I was looking at a rerun, and he had actually already died. And the show had been originally aired like 2 or 3 months earlier. And at one time during the interview, Charlie Rose asked him, well, what death was.
Yeah.
And Sagan said, it's a long, dreamless sleep, you know, quoting Shakespeare. Mm. And I thought, well, that can't be possibly true. You know, sleep is rather pleasant. Your heart's beating. Your lungs are breathing. This man's in denial. And sure enough, sleep is nothing like death. And so I thought, well, I want to find out what death is. Is it possible to know what death is? And I started with the simple question, how do we know when people are dead?
Yeah.
And that I never got beyond that question. That's such a troubling question. You can never get to the topic of who's dead or what death is.
Right. Well, you talk about that you kind of ditched the article. You didn't end up writing it. Why did you come back? I mean, did you know at the time? I'm sure you've discovered now since you're getting a lot of reaction, obviously, to the book, some criticism about it, and which we'll get into some of the particulars about all of this. Mm-hmm. But was that why you kind of backed out at first? Was you figured, man, this is fraught with a lot of stuff. I'm not sure if I'm ready for it yet.
I backed out because there was too much information for an article.
Huh.
And certainly there was not enough information for a positive article, which I had envisioned an article, oh my gosh, technology has now solved a problem that's befuddled us for 5,000 years, and I didn't find that at all.
Yeah.
I knew there'd be criticism, yeah. But journalists, that's we live for that, right?
Right. I want to talk about the parameters for the book. I mean, you focus on, as you say in the book, physical death, on the scientific
yes.
information about physiological death. But you say it's hard to get at that information because there's this struggle going on between science and culture. Explain what you mean.
Well, science is looking for answers, even if they're ugly answers. And the culture isn't. The culture, there are certain things that we want. We want some people to be dead. And we don't like being disturbed by the fact that they may not be dead. The prime example in the book is organ transplants.
Yeah.
We have I think it's 114,000 people on a waiting list waiting for organs at this point. And they need people to be brain dead so their organs can be harvested and given to them. And so there's wishful thinking that who's dead and who's alive. And we would like to expand the pool of dead people. And we would like to expand it into those people who aren't really dead, because people who are just a little bit alive are mostly dead. They have healthier organs than if we wait for the heart to stop and for the blood to stop circulating and the organs to stop receiving oxygen and nutrients from the bloodstream. So it's wishful thinking and societal needs contradict science or go head-to-head with science, and science often loses in those situations.
Has the book given you any insights about why it is we're so anxious about death? I mean, it makes sense that we are. We have no way of knowing, of course, what's to come. But do you think you understand that sense of denial any better? You write about this sense of denial. It's we've always had it, I guess.
Well, I found some scientists who did what they called mortality salience experiments, yeah, where they would ask people, you know, they'd give them questionnaires, supposedly on a subject unrelated to death, but somewhere in the lead up to the questionnaire, they would ask them to visualize their death and what it would be like when they're dead. And the control groups were not asked this question. And they found that being very sort of subliminally reminded of one's death makes one change one's world, not change one's worldview, I misspoke, but to guard one's worldview very preciously. For example, the most dramatic example, they gave this test, this experiment on judges.
Yeah.
And
in
they
Arizona,
asked them,
yeah,
in Albuquerque, yeah, and they asked them, they gave them cases of prostitutes who had been arrested, and they asked them to what bail would they set for these prostitutes. Now, it's a simple question because there are state guidelines on, yeah, what the bail should be.
Yeah.
But and the people who were not reminded of their death gave those guidelines. The ones who were reminded of their death set bails 9 times higher than the others. And no one thought that a judge would leap over the guidelines to such an extent. But they'd been scared. And when you get scared, you tend to circle the wagons philosophically and psychologically. These scientists also attempted, and I don't know how right they attempted to predict the 2004 election, saying that George Bush would really appeal to more people because he had a very strong sense of good and evil, and 9/11 had reminded people of their mortality, and they wanted someone who was strong and would protect American ideals and American ideas. I think that's a little far-fetched, but that is what is happening. When we're reminded of our death, we become kind of nervous.
Yeah. You quote the anthropologist Ernest Becker said that consciousness, I guess it works this way, consciousness has sort of brought human beings into this conflict with that drive to survive and then that awareness of our own impending death. That he called us hyper-anxious animals.
Yes, yes. Yes, well, you have the what he was saying is that I don't know if he's right about this, that we're the only animal who has the same drive from our genes as other animals, meaning survive, survive, survive. But we're the only animal who is conscious enough to realize we're not going to survive,
yeah,
that it's all futile. And this sort of conflict sort of drives us a little bit nuts. Now, I don't know that other animals don't have that consciousness. But certainly human beings do appear to be a little bit nuts. And it made me realize that one of the things we do, like we build statues for ourselves and we endow libraries and we do genealogy when we get old to give us a sense of, you know, surviving through the ages. We construct elaborate wills so that we can reach out from the grave. And I might also add that some of us write books to –
right,
to give ourselves some sort of memory beyond the grave.
So we create culture too. I guess as Becker puts it, we want to assure ourselves that we've done something of worth, even though we know we're not going to be around forever.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Explain because you mentioned this in the book how the constant exposure to death, you say, has lowered your sense of anxiety. You feel more mellow about it, which is, I think, interesting. I don't know why. I guess I figured you might be more stressed out about it, but that didn't work that way.
At first
you.
I was,
yeah.
Yes. At first I was stressed out about it. And Sheldon Solomon, who did those mortality salience experiments, he said that in his experiments, he subliminally reminded people of their death. But he's talking about like Franciscan brothers who spend all their time looking at – or not all their time, but spend a good deal of time looking at skulls and contemplating death, they reach a point of mellowness that you realize that everything is temporary. Hmm. And I think after the initial fear, and I was – I would wake up in a cold sweat sometimes of, you know, studying this, a mellowness did kind of descend upon me that things didn't seem so important anymore. I stopped caring about what people thought. I think I became more of an authentic person and not worrying about what was happening in the world. And I think that has to do with being confronting death every day of my life.
Has it helped you deal with some of the criticism of the book? I mean, I figure you've got a pretty thick skin, but did that help you at all?
I think so. Well, I mean, I've been a journalist all my life,
yeah.
And I'm 66, so I've gone through a lot of this on a number of topics. So that's mostly it. You know, you get pretty hardened. If you write anything worthwhile, someone's going to object to it. But another thing I did, I didn't read my reviews. That helped.
Yeah, it must. But I don't want to make this – I mean, there is some criticism of some of the ideas in there, but I guess I'm making it sound as if it's really – well, it is provocative, to be sure. And there's a lot of attention paid to the question, which we'll get to, of course, of, you know, the organ donation industry. I guess do you worry that there's so much focus on that part, that the other parts, the questions of denial, the other questions about death – are kind of being put aside, that people aren't really talking about that part of the book?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not really a book about organ transplants.
Yeah.
It turned out that this drew the most fire and drew the most interest because it is kind of unsettling. But I was really writing a long riff about death. And there are, you know, many things in there about death outside of brain death and organ transplant. It's interesting. I got diabetes when I started this book, and I got a questionnaire from my medical insurance company saying a lot of diabetics are depressed, and maybe you need help with that. And part of the questionnaire said, "Do you ever think about death?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And then it said yearly, monthly, weekly, daily, and I wrote down daily. And they said, "Well, how many times per day?" I said, 70 or so, you know, because I was researching a book about death.
Yeah.
And next time I saw my attorney, she said, whoa, your insurance company wants you to see a psychotherapist. They think you're really, really depressed. I explained to her why I thought 70 times a day about death. And they said, "Well, they're still upset. Then they'll pay for it if you'll go." And so I went to a psychotherapist. I said, "How can you help me with this? I think about death." And working on this book for several years, I now sort of have a greater grasp on the concept that I will die. You know, it's something I put the back of my mind that we all do. But for sure, I'm going to die. And what kind of therapy helps a person who knows he's going to die, maybe not imminently, but eventually, to live his life more fully with that knowledge in mind? And she said there really wasn't any. There was bereavement therapy. There was therapy for people who were terminally ill, et cetera. But there wasn't any sort of therapy for the person who just says, "Oh, this is terminal. My life, everybody's life is terminal. How do I live these, say, last 10 or 15 years?"
Dick Teresi is with us. He's the author of the book The Undead, Organ Harvesting, The Ice Water Test, Beating Heart Cadavers, How Medicine is Blurring the Line Between Life and Death. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Dick Teresi. We're talking about his latest book, The Undead. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I wanted to ask about, again, the question that really got you thinking about, you know, when are you dead? And one of the things you write about is the history of our concern for that question. I guess we've always really worried about this question. And it really wasn't until I guess, recently, in some sense, that it was a medical question, or given to the doctors this question.
Well, that's right. Our species has not trusted doctors for 5,000 years. The ancient Egyptians, for example, they brain death to them wouldn't make any sense because the brain didn't make any sense to them. Yeah. And the mummies, they just hollowed out the skull and threw away the brains. They felt the heart was key. And if a doctor or an embalmer made the mistake of declaring death too quickly, they would be stoned. As you mentioned, the ancient Greeks would cut off a finger. The early Hebrews were very close to a good definition of death when they said it was a putrefaction.
Yeah.
Putrefaction really is the result of almost total cell death. And the cell is kind of the atom of life, you might say. And we just don't like to wait that long. So there have been attempts to not have to wait for putrefaction, for the person to rot away in our homes. And we haven't trusted doctors until recently because doctors have made mistakes. The Pope, for example, you mentioned the Romans and their habit of conclamation where they yell out the person's baptismal name three times.
Yeah.
That's the way popes are still declared dead. It's not the doctors. The doctors will give their opinion that, you know, this man is dead. But then there's a cardinal called the Camerlengo who comes in and he yells the Pope's name three times into his ear, and then he hits him in the forehead three times with a silver hammer to see if he will answer. He's not dead till the Camerlengo says he's dead. And the Camerlengo is not a doctor. He is appointed directly by the Pope, someone he trusts, and someone whose job vanishes the moment he declares the Pope dead.
Mm.
So he's not likely to call it too quickly. It's only been in the last couple of centuries where doctors have started to take over the responsibility of saying who's dead and who's alive. And it was as late as 1981 in this country when doctors, and mostly doctors, have been given the right to call people brain dead, and that their decision is final and there's no appeal. And even if they've made a mistake, according to the law of 1981, they cannot be arrested for murder. They cannot be sued civilly for making these mistakes. So at the present time, doctors are kind of all-powerful and beyond responsibility.
You trace it a little earlier than 81, the critical change happening 1968 when – as you explain it in the book, these 13 men at Harvard Medical School made this determination about what it meant to be brain dead. And what's interesting about it, as you say in the book, they didn't really have any data, you say. They didn't really have any patients to refer to. I think you put it this way, they were winging it.
Well, I think they were winging it. And it's clear when you look at the documents and that the correspondence between them, there was no real need for a new standard of death. The cardiopulmonary standard had been pretty effective for a number of decades, you know, when your heart stops beating and you start breathing. But they were driven by the need for organs because organ transplantation had leaped tremendously since the first solid organ transplant in the 1950s, which was a kidney. And immunosuppressive drugs had come to the fore, making transplantation more impossible. Techniques had improved. And on that panel of 13 men was Joseph Murray, who would win the Nobel Prize for doing the first kidney transplant. And there were other transplant doctors on that committee. And what they really wanted was a quicker determination of death so they could call people dead whose hearts were still beating and whose organs could be kept fresh. And they protested that they had other reasons, but really it was the transplant thing that drove them. And that was in 68, but it wasn't law. And most of their paper, which is I think only 3.5 pages long, as you say, there were no patients studied. There were no medical studies cited. It was mostly a legal argument on why this should be true and why they shouldn't be arrested. That was mostly it. And like 13 years later, it became law in all 50 states.
Mm. You know, you referred to the Pope's representative who is invested with the idea that the Pope be alive. I mean, he's more invested with the idea that the Pope be alive than be dead. And it raises the question that you seem to be raising about doctors, that they're more invested, that they're not actually invested in the idea that the patient be alive. They're more invested that they be dead so they can use their organs. But that sounds kind of oversimplified. But is it what you're saying?
Yes, that's what I'm saying, yeah. In 1954, when Joseph Murray did the first organ transplant, solid or a kidney, and that was using a live donor, identical twins, one twin to another. A number of doctors said that the Hippocratic Oath was now dead, which says, first, do no harm, because you are doing harm. You're doing harm to, even though the donor does not die, it's not good to have your back cut open and a kidney removed. And so that's sort of been out the window ever since 1954. And what has been – I mean, lawyers have higher standards than this. A lawyer will not bargain – is not supposed to bargain one client against another, saying, well, tell the DA, well, you can have – send this guy to the death chamber if you'll let this guy off. And – but that's what doctors in the transplant business are doing. They're saying there are valuable people in this world, and they're the 114,000 people on the transplant waiting list. And I'm not saying they're not valuable, but – the donors are quite a bit less valuable to them. And so when they see someone, not all doctors, but when they see a person edging toward death, they start thinking about the 114,000 that they can save. And I'm not saying all doctors, but doctors in this business.
You also mentioned the sort of the monetary value of a body. It's a $20 billion business, the transplant industry you mentioned. The transplant value of the human body, $2 million they can be.
Well, better figures. It's the business is now $27 billion a year, and that doesn't include tissue transplants, skin for whatever, and bones. The average donor yields about 3.3 solid organs, pancreas, kidneys, heart, lungs, et cetera. And so each donor is worth about, harvested donor is worth anywhere from about $800,000 to $2.7 million. And the great thing about this for the organ transplant business is that federal law says that donors may not be paid for their organs. So that's adds to the bottom line when you're getting your raw materials for free.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call. Kristen is with us in Pensacola, Florida. Kristen, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I find it interesting. I actually heard an interview with you, Dick, earlier that was not a call-in. This was several weeks ago. And I downloaded your book, and I haven't really had a chance to read it yet. But my mother passed away in February. And she had a massive subarachnoid hemorrhage, and while she was at work, and I, got this strange phone call and showed up, and they said they did a CT scan, and she was brain dead. And so, I asked them, well, okay, what does that mean exactly? And he said, well, we did consult with a neurosurgeon who looked at the scan and agreed with us, but it was such a massive bleed that it destroyed her brain kind of from the inside out, and there was massive swelling and all that type of thing. And, of course, that was devastating, but I'm kind of a philosophical kind of person, and I was remember sitting there looking at her just thinking, well, she, just like you said, she looks normal. If she'd gotten in a car wreck and she was all kind of mangled, at least I could say, yes, she's definitely not with us anymore. But they assured us, and I asked to see the CT myself, which I did, and I mean, it was pretty obvious. It was a mess, but I thought it was interesting how human nature kind of creeps in, because the nurse, the overnight shift nurse, she had come in and she was swabbing my mother's mouth with one of those little swabs, moisturizing swabs, and they had already taken her off the ventilator. And it took her a good two full days to quit breathing. But she said my mom just kind of clamped down on the swab while she was swabbing her mouth, and she couldn't get it out. And she said, open your mouth. Open your mouth. She said it louder, and my mom opened her mouth. And, of course, that's the one thing that really stands out to me. And looking at a scan and seeing the massive amount of blood, I mean, I don't have any doubt that she definitely was not, quote, with us anymore. But it's interesting how one little thing that a nurse can do, because we're all human, can just plant that seed of doubt in your mind. I've just been really intrigued by your work, and I was wondering if you had any kind of comment. I don't know if there's any kind of training that an ICU nurse could ever get to say, hey, you know, be careful what you say.
Well, Dick Teresa, one of the important points you make in the book is that there is technology available to decide whether someone is dead.
Yes, there is, and they just tend not to use it. This the caller's mother sounds that she did get some technology, but often not. The brain death, the 1981 law calls for the person to have the whole brain dead, but they don't really test the whole brain. The test we saw in Fernanda, and which you mostly get in this country, only tests whether the brain stem, which is the stalk at the bottom of the brain, whether that's operative or not. And they assume if that's down, that everything else is down. And there are confirmatory tests, such as EEGs and blood flow studies, that can tell you whether the cortex is down or not. And they tend not to do them. So we don't really know. We're doing this by implication that we're pretty sure most of the brain is dead if the bottom part is dead. But certainly that's not necessarily true.
When you write about
and you can see that if a nurse is talking to a patient who's supposedly dead, then the nurse who sees people all day long must have some grave doubts.
When you write about the fact that people declared dead come back to life, as you've put it, with some frequency, people in drowning circumstances, from comas, from asphyxia, from lightning strikes. It happens from time to time. And you also mentioned that rigor mortis can actually occur in the living. Never heard that.
Yeah, it can. All these, through 5,000 years, we have cataloged signs of death. And through 5,000 years, we have also cataloged how those signs are often wrong. Heart stopping. We don't hear the heartbeat. We don't know that the lungs are still operating. Rigor mortis is caused by something other than death. Hypothermia, drowning victims, etc., often come back to life. This was noted in the 1968 Harvard paper, but they only listed a couple of examples, and we keep adding to those examples. And are doctors aware of them? And studies show, no, they're not aware of it. They're not even sure what the standards for brain death are. Most of them could not name the criteria for brain death, but yet they were pronouncing it. People are pretty badly trained. And like I say, the main problem is the rush for the organs. Fortunately or unfortunately, brain death only happens to maybe a little more than 1% of the population. The rest of us all die in the plain vanilla way of death of our heart stops and we start breathing. And that's a pretty safe way of being called dead.
Mention Adrian Owen, if you would, who found that a good percentage of people in this, what we figured was a kind of a vegetative state, were in fact conscious in some way.
Well, yeah, we're talking here about PVS, or persistent vegetative state.
Right.
A state that was described by Dr. Fred Plum back in the early 1970s. And he developed a series of bedside simple tests, just like for brain death, that would tell you whether someone was in PVS or not. And PVS, unlike the brain dead, the PVS's patient's brainstem is fully operational, so he doesn't need a ventilator. But his cortex is theoretically dead, so he's not conscious. And what Owen found using PET scans and others is that 43%, huge percentage of PVS patients he looked at were conscious. And some have been in PVS for 4 years. What Owen did that no one else was doing, or few others were doing at the time, was he listened to the families. The families were saying, by God, you know, when someone comes in, when an old friend comes in our PVS patient's room, he seems to brighten up. Or when a certain doctor doesn't like comes in, he just freezes up. And these families have always been told that they were hallucinating or that it was wishful thinking. And he found, no, you just have to look. You have to look for signs. You have to do PET scans. He was able to communicate with some via buzzers, hand buzzers. Some were able to do math problems, believe it or not. You just have to look really closely. And one of the reasons for the errors in diagnosis was that many of the tests that Plum and his colleagues developed back in the 70s were visual tests, testing the eyes. Well, it turns out that a lot of people in PVS are in that state as a result of stroke. And stroke can blind you. And I shouldn't really have to tell you that blind people do very poorly on visual tests.
Dick Terese is with us. He's a science writer, co-author of The God Particle, among other books. He's been an editor-in-chief at Science Digest, Omni, among others. He's joining us today from the studios of New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts. Kristen, thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is called The Undead, Organ Harvesting, The Ice Water Test, Beating Heart Cadavers, How Medicine is Blurring the Line Between Life and Death. We'll take a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Dick Terese. We're talking about his book, The Undead. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Now, let's go back to the phones. Alex is with us in Salt Lake. Alex, welcome.
Hi, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was wondering what kind of comment does that make about our society? Do we value life more or less with our desire to perhaps save a life that can function at a higher quality, or take a life that might not quite be done yet? Do we value it more or less? And also, the amount of money that's involved in this process, does that almost just eliminate any kind of real answer to that question? Thank you. I'll take it off the air. Bye.
Thanks very much. What do you make of that question? It's interesting, Dick Terese, before you respond, because you write in the book that you know that when you had heard criticism or concern from people you were talking to as you were preparing for the book, that you would always respond by saying, look, I'm just a journalist reporting the facts. I'm not making any moral judgments. But what do you make of questions that in some ways do require some kind of judgment, like the question of the quality of life? What do you make of Alex's question?
Well, that's a good question. And I would say the first step before you make that decision are, do we care about the donors or should we care about the recipients of organs, is that we ought to tell the truth. And we ought to tell the truth that these people that we're harvesting are not biologically dead. They're legally dead but not biologically dead. If your heart's still beating, you're probably not dead. If you're thrashing around on the operating table, which they do, and hospitals are warned to keep donor families away from the donor after they've been declared brain dead, because they're going to see them moving. When you cut into a donor and his blood pressure goes sky high, just like a patient who has not been anesthetized enough, those things ought to be conveyed to the public, and they certainly ought to be conveyed to anyone before they sign up as an organ donor. We could then, if we had this all out in the open, we might decide as a society that, so what? We need these organs, and we think it's okay to call people dead before they're really quite dead, because they're not going to live much longer anyway. You could make that decision. But I think before you make that decision, and there had to be a public debate, and before there's a public debate, the actual facts have to be brought out in the open. And they're not. They're lied about.
So your problem, you think that we could come to a decision to say, look, this, you know, 58-year-old man who was hit in an intersection. He's legally dead. His heart is still beating, but he's legally dead. And it's okay that we go in and take his heart in favor of the 17-year-old boy who's suffering from a congenital heart defect somewhere else, who's waiting for that. As long as we're just out front about it, if we're transparent, we can say, look, this guy's not going to make it. And it will be to the advantage of the 17-year-old boy. We can say that, but we've just got to be more honest about it. That's what you're saying, it seems.
Well, I think before we can make that decision, we have to be honest about it, and then there has to be some sort of public referendum. Let me just change what you've said one thing. It's more likely that the 17-year-old boy is going to be harvested for the benefit of the 54-year-old man. And it's more likely that a poorer person is going to be harvested to give a heart to a more well-off person. It's going to be more likely that the person who is harvested is not a doctor, because doctors do not sign up as organ donors. And doctors who are involved in the procurement process of taking organs, they are the lowest among doctors in being donors themselves, having seen the process. I think all that should be out in the open, and then we can decide whether it's okay to call people to harvest them while they're still alive.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let's go back to the phones. Angela is joining us from Dalton, Georgia. Angela, welcome.
Thank you, number one, for writing this book. My question is, I am an organ donor, but with this knowledge, how would I legally become a non-organ donor?
And I guess, Dick Tracy, do you want that? Do you want people questioning whether or not they're organ donors? Is that really the conclusion that you want people to come to?
Well, I think it's fine to be an organ donor as long as you have the facts. And well, there is some, as I alluded to, that there's some concern that organ donors may be conscious or in pain during the harvest process. There's no good evidence one way or the other, but they seem to have all the symptoms of people in pain. And no one wants to do any real experiments like do PET scans or whatever to find out if they are or are not in pain, because it's not a question anyone wants to address. But one scientist told me that even if he knew for sure that he would be in pain, that he was a Christian, he still wanted to donate his organs. If he had to suffer, he said, like Jesus suffered for us, he would suffer, and that would make his contribution in fact, more meaningful. So I'm not saying don't be an organ donor, but I think people should know the facts.
Are you an organ
donor?
Are you an organ donor, Dick Tracy?
Not on my license. No, I'm. You can. You don't have to sign it up on your license. You can, you know, you can leave a living will or directions to your family. I'm toying with the idea of saying I want my organs to go to someone without medical insurance. And that would eliminate any kind of profit motive. But no, I certainly wouldn't rule it out. I think you could have – now, if you do, I dealt directly with about three different organ banks and said, you know, I'd like to have my own doctor there at the brain death determination. I'd like to have anesthetic, because sometimes anesthetic is given during a harvest. And I put forward these conditions, and they basically said get lost, you know. But – if you do it at the time that you're dying, if your family has a document from you saying, here are our conditions, I think you're going to get those, because they want, you know, that, like I said, your body's worth between $800,000 and $2.7 million. I think they're ready to deal. And I've talked with the National Organization of OPOs, Organ Procurement Organizations, or organ banks, and they said, yes, they are bargaining more now than they ever have before.
Angela, glad you called. Thanks. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Back to the phones. Noam is joining us in Chicago. Noam, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I wanted to point out that when thinking about death, the first thing that's important is to identify what exactly it is that is life. And so you have to identify what life is before you decide what death is. And in 1968, the Harvard Commission specifically stated that an organ that ceases to function is no longer alive, and they identified that organ as the brain. And so when you're thinking about what a person is dead, is when his brain no longer functions. And so you can certainly argue about which particular functions of the brain need to be gone, but it starts with a cerebral definition of that the brain is a human being. If there's any question about that, you can do a thought experiment where you take a head and detach it from the body, have both of them have a pump so that they're both functioning, and then decide which one is the person, the head or the body. And so the brain death criteria identify those people who have lost observable brain function, which is what they eventually decided was the appropriate definition of death. Now, you can decide that you want some other definition of cerebral function to be the definition of death, but that's a matter for discussion.
Dick Tracy, what do you think?
That's a modern view, and it's a neo-Darwinistic view, that humans are a species apart from all other life forms. I don't buy it. As one doctor who's anti-brain death pointed out, we don't have a concept of squirrelness, for example. If a squirrel's heart is beating, we don't say, oh, but he's lost all the attributes of a squirrel or whatever. We go on strictly biological grounds. And I'm thinking we should get back to that with human beings. Now, a brain-dead person, you tell me if you think this is a person who's dead. A brain-dead person will still be breathing on a ventilator, mm-hmm. but he's still capable of breathing with the ventilator. His heart will be beating. His organs will be functioning. He'll react to a scalpel incision. He can get a high pulse or high blood pressure. He will get bed sores while he's waiting to be harvested. He can have heart attacks and be resuscitated. He'll be producing brain waves. His body temperature will remain warm. He can get wounds and infections, and he can heal them. Children who have been brain dead for a long period of time continue to grow, and they will sexually mature. Brain dead pregnant mothers can still deliver their babies. One woman was kept alive for 107 days after being declared death. I think giving birth is a sign of life, despite what your caller said. The brain is not the end all and be all of what a human being is.
But how do you throw the idea of quality of life into the equation? Should it even be there?
Well, again, you can still have definitions on who's dead and who's alive. Yeah. And you can say, well, this person's alive, but the quality of their life isn't worth going on, you know. Yeah. I think that's perfectly valid. The thing that happens with organ transplants is we're not cutting these people off short. We're keeping them alive so that we can harvest them. Many of these people go brain dead, would go plain vanilla dead with their hearts and lungs stopping if we didn't keep them on the ventilator. That's what people don't realize, is that when you're declared brain dead and you're an organ donor, they hook the ventilator right back up again so that your heart continues to beat. They're prolonging your life. They are giving you – you are becoming what's called a beating heart cadaver. So – and we're taking these pregnant dead – brain dead women, and we're extending their lives by months. I can't imagine what that quality of life is. And I think the same thing you see on the other end. I think you have to take a harder look at organ recipients. Some of them lead pretty dreadful lives after receiving their organs. It's very expensive. Many of their families go bankrupt paying for the immunosuppressive drugs during post-op, which are usually not covered by medical insurance.
Noam, thanks very much. Back to the phones. Chris is with us in Salt Lake. Chris, we don't have much time, but welcome.
Hi. Just a few things. Questioning some of this guy's knowledge, first of all, it's not called harvesting. It hasn't been called harvesting in 15 years. It's been called procurement. He says that you can – he doesn't mention that when you – the most common way to join the registry now besides driver's license is almost every state, if not every state, has a donor registry online, and that's a pretty common way to do it. He doesn't mention that as far as I know. And also, having worked in the business myself, most doctors, at least in Utah, who are transplant surgeons, are very willing to be organ donors themselves. And then the last point, I'll let you respond – is my understanding is that anesthesia is used during the process. And he makes it sound like people that it's not a common thing.
Well, there's a lot there. Chris, let me ask you, what's wrong with the word harvest?
Harvesting, I think that most of us, I would think that harvesting sounds, I don't know, it sounds more brutal in a way than procurement.
Yeah. Well, you, Dick Tracy, talk about, I don't know if you have time to get to all of that. Start with the language question. People don't like the word harvest.
Well, it tends to discourage donors if you use the word harvest. It marginalizes them. But it's a good word. The words they prefer are, like, as this man said, procurement. Recovery is another word, which are all phony words. When they take your kidneys out, recovering means – or retrieve they use. They're not retrieving them. Retrieve means to find again, something that's been lost. Your kidneys are right where they're supposed to be, and you're back there. Your heart's right where it's supposed to be. They're not retrieving or recovering anything. They're harvesting you. They're giving it to someone else. They're giving it to a paying customer. So, yes, they try to manipulate the language. But harvest is a word I prefer because it tells you what's happening.
You want to say anything? Got about a minute left in response. Chris brought up a number of different things. Anything else you want to mention briefly?
Well, you know, there are different ways of donating your organs. I would prefer not to do it in advance. You know, have a document for your family and ignore the license, ignore the registry. In terms of anesthesia, I tried to get a number of how many doctors during harvest use anesthesia, and it's impossible because they don't like to talk about it. To give anesthesia to a donor begs the question, doesn't it? It tells you you're not sure this person is dead. You're not sure this person isn't capable of feeling pain. So they try to sidestep that issue, and there are no real good numbers. But there are some doctors, transplant doctors, who will in fact use anesthesia, who are, you know, a little more caring than others.
Dick Tracy, his book is called "The Undead: Organ Harvesting, the Ice Water Test, Beating Heart Cadavers: How Medicine Is Blurring the Line Between Life and Death." Dick Tracy, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.